Hi, my name is Roy Carlin, and welcome to the show. I've also got Fight Podcast, The Awakening Podcast, Exposing Fraud and Corruption, but with Solutions, The Crypto Podcast, on the road, all things blockchain, NFTs, crypto, The Meditation Podcast, talking about all different types of meditation, but there's also meditations there from 1 minute to 2 hours. And the other one's the Learn Polish Podcast, so if you're interested in learning Polish, you can do that. And the other one is Speaking with Roy Colin, and I just have guests from around the world talking about either public speaking or also about their book or just general life in general. And you find everything on bio.link/podcaster. I'm also a podcasting coach, and you see the QR code there, and it's also on my link as well. And if you're interested in actually going on some podcast shows, I'm helping people doing that. Or if you're interested in sponsorship, you can contact me. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, danielpacker.com. He helps people with anxiety, stress, and addictions. He's got a 90% success rate, and you only pay if you're successful. So be sure to check him out, danielpacker.com. I hope you enjoy this week's show. Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. My guest today, from New York in the USA, published her first book at 85. Previously a family therapist, divorce mediator, Broadway and off-Broadway producer, musical book writer, screen producer and teacher, co-wrote and produced films, and there's actually a lot more, but I mean, if I started telling all the fantastic things that you've done, it'd be the end of the show. So please welcome Jennifer Manchurian. Did I do it?
Manchurian. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I've lived a long life, many chapters, and more to come. It isn't over.
And just, I have finished your book. This is your book. And to be honest, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Because
thank you.
There's times that I kind of, you know, you get a book and you kind of say, oh, I have to read this for something. This is one that I really enjoyed reading. I was like, what's happening next? Ah. And there's so many twists and turns. You're a fantastic writer. Right? It was like very well written.
That is so nice. And it took a lot to get it to you. I think we had to send it 2-3 times. And anyway, I'm so glad you liked it. That makes me happy.
Well, so I suppose.
Make my day. Can we end now?
I mean, you have done some incredible things. And how much of your career did you incorporate? Because I'm not going to mention the book. I want you to kind of disclose what you want on the book, because I want people to go and get this. Because I definitely, you will enjoy this read. Of your own experience, did you incorporate into it?
Everything and nothing. Or should I say everything and there are some things that happened in my life without, I think, a spoiler. I mean, there's a scene, for example, where an old man is hospitalized, an emergency hospitalization. And I took the scene, not the character, but that experience. I took that right out of my life in something that happened with my father that was very frightening. And it was like, it's funny, when my son read the book, he called me up when he read that chapter. He said, Mom, I mean, that was so real for me. I mean, because he had been there. He had been there with my father. It was scary. He did Code Blue twice. So it was not a fun experience. So there are things that, I mean, how can anybody write a book without bringing something of themselves into it? You couldn't write the same book I wrote. If somebody gave you the plot, the characters, we all write from what we know of people, what we know of life, how we see people. I mean, the book is told through multiple points of view. There are 7 characters, and then there's a medium who gets a little time, not a lot. And she gets actually only 1 chapter, but she's, I didn't have a medium. Actually, I've had the experience of going to not a medium, but a psychic a couple of times. And, but the characters, it's a diverse amount of characters, and I felt that I knew enough about it's different. It goes from the age of, well, actually there's a teenage girl, but she's not a main character, but so she's like the youngest character in the book, and the oldest is 95. and in between all different and different. There's a couple. There's some men in the book. There's some women, people of different ages. I felt like I knew enough about who these people are to make them authentic, because authenticity is, to me, the key to a good book.
Fantastic. So you're like, I suppose let's kind of go back a few years. And I mean, because prior to Regarding, you mentioned that I believe your father is English. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So you might kind of talk about your upbringing and then how you kind of got into writing. Was this something that you started early? Because I mean, with your career, the screenwriting and everything, obviously you've been writing a lot, but I'm not sure when it all started.
Well, I mean, it's you know, I've had to think about things like that. I come from a family that was, I would say, literary, although not everybody published novels and stuff, but it was a family of readers. My father was an intellectual. You know, he always reminds me of somebody like Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, who was so kind of that, I'm sorry, but that kind of intellectual superiority where you always feel dumb. But that was my father. But everybody read, everybody and wrote. Both of my parents, and I didn't find this out until after they died, and I found journals that my mother wrote. And my mother died at 94, my father at 95. So they had a long life. And I found my mother had written journals, and apparently both of my parents desperately wanted, they had three daughters that they had to educate, and, you know, educate well, because that was really important. My father being English, you know, the English, my aunt who lived in India sent her daughter to England to be educated when she was like six. You know, education was very big in his family. And so there was, they wanted to make sure we were really well educated. Of course, I was a rebel and I dropped out of college, but I won't talk about that right now. I finally got back. But my parents both wanted to write the great American novel, or a novel that would support them, so in a way that they could live a good life and educate their three daughters. And so both of them wrote novels, and I found them, and they didn't make it. But we just wrote. Listen, we also lived in an era where people actually wrote letters. Do you remember that era?
I do indeed. Yeah.
Everything wasn't electronic. But I've always liked to write, and writing is how I formulate my own thinking. So if something's really bothering me, I may write just to kind of get a handle on it. It helps, it calms me down, and it also helps me think. And in fact, I can't really write longhand anymore. I have terrible handwriting. So I go to my computer and I write what I need to write. If I have something bothering me, you know, something about one of my kids, something I feel like I need to say, but I don't want to, you know, kids don't always want to hear what you want to say. And my children are all adults with their own children, but I'll formulate, you know, in my mind, I strategize. And I wrote when my kids were little, I was writing screenplays and, you know, actually, when many, many years ago, I don't know how many, but a long time ago, I wrote a screenplay, and I actually almost had it optioned. And I went to a lawyer, and it was an interesting experience. The lawyer showed me, he was a very prominent lawyer for this type of thing. And he looked at me, he said, "Look at that shelf in back of me. Do you see all those scripts that are never going to get made?" He was very encouraging, but somebody did want to option it, but I was foolishly, he wanted a period of time to try to see if he could finance it before the meter began ticking. And I thought, no. And afterwards I thought, oh God, why did I say that? I should have given it a try. That would have gotten me started in this field much sooner, much earlier.
So you mentioned the rebel.
Oh, you said how I grew up.
No, I want to go into the rebel Jennifer, because I know, let's hope your children and grandchildren don't hear this, but let's hear about the rebel Jennifer.
Can I whisper? they know about it because I send them the most inappropriate text messages, not videos. Rebel, by rebel, I mean that I have two sisters, I'm in the middle, and my older sister is 6 years older. And she went to a very good private school. And, she would be, she and my father would be, you know, quoting Wordsworth or Keats or whoever they'd be quoting. And my father would start some line and expect me when I was about 8 to be able to match that. So, you know, I became an underachiever. It was just too much to compete with. We used to eat. It's unbelievable today how families don't even eat together. But we would have dinner every night for like an hour and the whole works. And we, you know, and we had to stay at the table and we had to eat everything on our plate and the conversation, you know, and I would be just sitting and trying to feed my dog under the table. I stopped trying to compete. To that extent, I'm sorry, it's not a more exciting rebel. But I became kind of the anti-intellectual. I was like different from my family. I was off riding my bike with my friends. And until I went away to school when I was in high school and I went to a boarding school, and I kind of wasn't on that, under that kind of heavy atmosphere of, can you keep, you know, keeping up. I started to find myself and it was very healthy for me. And I had teachers who believed in me and great teachers. And so I all of a sudden realized, well, wait a minute. Maybe I'm not so dumb after all. So that was my rebellion.
And what's life like in a boarding school? I'd never been in a boarding school.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
It was very, people love it or they hate it. I mean, maybe some people just go along, but it was very, very good for me. It was really where I've developed interests that have served me all my life. Things that I would have never done. I mean, like we had to take art history courses. Now, if my parents wanted to take me to a museum, I want to go, you know, the country club or something. Not the country club, but you know what I mean. I want to bike with my friends. So I had art history courses and I discovered art. And I mean, all these things became lifelong interests. Every Sunday, my father would play the Philharmonic. And he had this machine that we weren't allowed to touch. It's called the Capehart. And God forbid we touch that Capehart and scratch something. But, you know, we had actually long playing records in those days. It was a different way of music. But we would be listening on the radio. And I used to think this was the most boring thing in the world. And today I go to chamber music concerts and I love it. And I often recognize music that I was said I had no interest in. So I absorbed a lot. Even though I was like acting like none of it interested me.
Excellent. But you mentioned like there's the Broadway and off-Broadway production. I'm not familiar with off-Broadway production. What does that mean?
Oh, well, I don't know what the equivalent would be, certainly where you live. But off-Broadway, well, it actually, the way in which they categorize it is by the number of seats in a theater. But most of the Broadway theaters are within a certain perimeter of Manhattan around Times Square. I think the minimum seats is probably maybe 800. I'm not talking in a very informed way because I don't have this in front of me, but it may be even less, but they're all kind of in the area of Times Square. Off-Broadway is maybe there's this house as high as 550, but I don't think so. So there's different, so that's basically, and it can be anywhere. An off-Broadway theater can be downtown. I'm sorry, I'm talking like people know what I'm talking about. Down in Greenwich Village, it could be, there can be, you know, further uptown. There's lots of places where they can be. And the chances are their prices are lower. However, and they're also, it's cheaper to mount. However, it's very, very hard to succeed off Broadway because they're competing with Broadway because Broadway prices these days can be so low that if you can get a ticket to the thing you think you need, let's just say Hamilton, because most people have heard of Hamilton. If you can get a ticket for Hamilton for like $100, which you probably can't, but if you could. And then the off-Broadway theater is like 85. Most people will say, well, wait, I need to see Hamilton. So, the off-Broadway theater people are going to hate me. I hope they don't hear this. But it's just really, really hard to succeed. And the shows that have succeeded the most have been branded elsewhere. Something like Avenue Q, which ran on Broadway for many years, then did a cheaper version, you know, not cheaper version, but they went off-Broadway because they kind of they could no longer sustain a Broadway audience, and they were very successful. So it's just different. And actually, there's a off-Broadway show I did many, many years ago. I'm one of many, many producers on it, so don't give me credit for the show. But it's I am above title producer, and it's Stomp, which most people have seen because it's all over the world. Have you heard of it?
Stomp, no.
No? Oh, well, not. All right, so not everybody's heard of it. But it's all percussion. Okay. It's very clever. It's all percussion, and it played. It's we're no longer playing on Broadway, off Broadway, but we do have a tour, and it plays. Well, anyway, it's an interesting. It was an. It's listen. Theater is most people think it's very glamorous, and maybe opening night is glamorous. It's not a glamorous business because it's really, really hard to succeed. Many, many shows that are running for a long time may never even recoup their initial investment. It's a very, very tough business. Most plays, I think 20% may succeed. So it's real, and it, you know, so you go into it and you lose other people's money and you probably lose some of your own. And it's a daunting business. But I love to be an audience member.
With the screenwriting then, what kind of tips could you give people? Is that something that you enjoy? Is there a lot of work in that? What's the difference between screenwriting and other types of writing?
Well, they're very different forms. There are certain basics, like you know, you have to have a good plot and you got to know where it starts and does it end and does it earn the ending. You also need to develop your characters. And that's really something that's, particularly as a teacher, I really emphasize character development. Because, and it's character development isn't, just imagining somebody. It's somebody who has to live in your head for a long time and become so real. You know how this person thinks, how that person talks. But in terms of the forms are so different. When you write, and theater writing is completely different too. All three of them are different because in theater, it's mostly people talking to each other or singing at each other. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Whereas mostly it's dialogue and it's dialogue driven, and you don't have you can't go as many places. You can't, you don't have the ability to open it up and the way you do in a movie where you can, do it anywhere. You can be anywhere. So it's much more confined, and the dialogue, of course, has to be. The dialogue in movie and screenwriting is very, very, calculated. I don't know if that's the right word, but it's every word has to be really chosen, or, what's the meaning of each scene and what is it you're trying to get out of it? And how does it move the story forward or help you know the characters better? So it's quite, quite different. And there's an economy to it. In screenwriting, you can start in London and wind up in Tokyo. You can go all over the world, and the camera does an enormous amount of. I say it does. It's like your best friend. It does a lot of work for you. It shows you things. If you say that in the novel they looked at each other with the eyes of love or something corny like that, in a movie you can see it. There's so much you can see. You can see, but by the same token, each scene, each person who's chosen, what they choose to say has to sound real, and yet it isn't real dialogue. If we met somewhere and we were sitting and schmoozing and we're talking about how'd you get here, how's the weather, the audience would die of boredom. So it has to be very precisely chosen what you write about in each scene and how it then moves the full story forward. Who's introduced in it? What if this person's introduced in the movie? What it's not just somebody introduced. What is that person? What purpose is that going to serve? Where is that person going to come in terms of the plot? Now, novel writing, which was hard for me, to be honest with you, because it's you don't have the camera. It's like I miss the camera in back of me, in back telling me, showing, setting the stage, showing the scene, showing every movement somebody makes. If somebody picks up a cup, a lot of that, a lot of, you have to let the audience see what's happening in each scene in the same sense, but you've got to write it for them. That was quite hard work for me, having been used to doing much more screenwriting and dialogue. So it took me a lot of having to go back to the drawing board and rethink it many times to get it so I felt like it was showed. It's funny, you talked about my family. To be honest with you, the apartment in the, which I think is another character in the book, it's an Upper West Side. It takes place in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And the apartment, I think it's an apartment building where several of the characters live. And I modeled it after my parents' apartment, which was on Central Park West in Manhattan. I don't place it on Central Park West, but it's so much in my mind, my parents' apartment, that I didn't know if I could show it to the readers in the same way that it was real to me. I mean, my sisters read it, and I mean, they knew in a second that it was the you know, we all know that apartment very intimately, but hopefully you read the book. Did you have a feel for the space, for the building, apartment?
Yeah, definitely. And I have proofread a lot of books for people. And when I wrote my own one, because I was just reading it, the amount of errors was embarrassing. And I was like, how is this possible? It was like, we're talking major amount. And I'm just curious with, you know, when you talked about the characters, the different characters and everything. Is there a chance that people can make the mistake that because you know the character, you forget parts to put down?
Totally. It's not just, you know, it's not just things that, like, for, I work with a group. There's a group of writing friends I have, and we go away every summer for like a week to write, and we read each other's work. And if they, I had them read it a couple of times, and then I also gave it to a developmental editor who gave me notes. And I'm thinking, why didn't I think of that? What was wrong with me? You know, it's like, you feel like it's just so obvious, but I don't know. Maybe people can just do it first time around, but I feel like it takes time to pick up all the kind of the richness of the a life of a person and figure out how to put all that stuff in. So it's like an intricate jigsaw puzzle. It's not a big jigsaw puzzle of a train and you see the ladder and you this, and it's kind of, but it's like the globe, the ocean or something, where how the hell do you link those pieces? And it just takes, you miss so much. And you also can't read it after a while. When you've been reading it so many times, you can write a sentence with a missing word and you fill in that word. So you don't even notice it.
So
it's not you.
So you previously was a divorce mediator, and does relationships in the book as well. And, you know, we just touched on it ourselves prior to recording, but because of, you know, a lot, especially during the last lockdown, a lot of relationships broke and everything. And perhaps you could give some advice for people, because I have seen it work both ways. I'm lucky, I have got a fantastic relationship. I even have a podcast. I have a beautiful child from that. But I've seen it with friends and it becomes terrible, and they use like kids with a pawn. But even if there's no kids involved, and it kind of just destroying assets and businesses. So you might let people know the best, a good way of doing it instead of the hatred way.
Well, listen, it depends upon how long people have been sitting up waiting for this and how angry they are. You know, if one person's cheated, they weren't expected. When people are really angry, it's very tough to mediate. It just is, and it's unfortunate. But, you know, I really draw more from my family therapy background, because one of the questions first of all, people are so unprepared for how hard divorce is, which is so, you know, it's so common in our culture. And so many people are divorced. that people don't realize that it's a, you know, it's like a hurricane hits you. It's, you know, what's the highest level? Like a level 5 hurricane hits you. Your life, you know, your kid, if you have kids, they're affected. Your finances are affected. I mean, it just turns your life upside down. And it's, I did a fair amount of research for a book chapter I wrote when I was in called The Family Life Cycle. This is a long time ago, about the effect of divorce. And I had done quite a bit of research on it. And maybe the research had changed, but at the time it felt like it was like a 2-year process of kind of getting back your life. And it also, if one person has been left and the other person wasn't expecting it, it's very hard for people to be fair-minded. But forgetting all that, in divorce mediation, people can come in. They both have other partners. They're both ready to move on with their life. And yet, once they are actually in the process of talking about the, you know, the assets and the kids and who's going to see what, who, it instills so much emotionality. I used to feel like a traffic cop. Sometimes I felt like, oh, I got to block the road here. I got to stand in front of the door. I mean, it's interesting that very few people can be cut and dried about it. And that's usually when both of them are at a point where they're ready for this marriage to end. But if it's somebody has been dropped and left for somebody else, and there's a lot of hurt, I can think of a lot of stories like that. And it's really unfortunate because then they poison their children. They may poison the custodian, the person who is with the children more, may wound up, which is often the mother, not necessarily, but often may poison the children against that other person. And it does so much damage because it hurts your children. You want your children to have healthy relationships with both parents. And it hurts the people too. I mean, it's just, I don't know what kind of advice you can give to people other than don't just think about yourself. Think about everybody else too. You know, and you want to be fair and you want to, you know, all right, the marriage is going to end and you're going to have to, you want it to end in a way that nobody's going to be, it's never, nobody, you're going to be, never be back to square one, but nobody's going to feel like they've really been taken advantage of. So I know cases where, you know, the kids have, you know, let me just give you the ugliest scenario. I keep talking about it as if it's children, although to say that people without children are not affected by divorce is foolish because they are. You know, it's something, even if you lose a friend, it's hard. You know, it's a very tough thing. But there are cases where if one parent accuses the other, it can be, you know, of like drunk driving, you know, drinking when they're driving or doing drugs, you know, smoking pot and driving, or sexually touching a child inappropriate. All they have to do is make that accusation and the court gets involved. And then the other parent will require supervised village and visitations. And it creates so much distance from the children and that parent. It's very hard to come back. So I'm totally with you. Amicable divorce with people whose focus is on the people who are hurt by a divorce. I mean, you're making the decision. Who are the people hurt? Who's focus on what those people are and what they need, and they don't need parents at war. And if both parents are able to move on with their lives and make healthy lives, children can adjust. Kids are adaptable, but they can also be hurt.
Absolutely. So the picture on your book, it's actually it's one that you'd see and it sticks out. So you might tell me about the picture that you decided on.
Well, our picture, I bet. Well, I love that picture. Actually, the publisher I worked with their design team, and I had given them ideas for thing I like. Somebody's told me, for example, that white is a very bad cover for a book because for some reason people don't notice it. This is just what I was told. But I did a little bit of research, and I also, there are certain colors that pop. And just, you know, go into a bookstore and, you know, look at the covers that you like. So I looked at covers that I liked and they were, I don't know, always something that would like stop you. Even if you didn't want to buy the book, it would at least make you open the pages and think, what is this book about? And so when they presented this, they presented me with a bunch of choices and none of them was right. I think I got like 4 at a time. I don't know. It was actually maybe 4 images and then versions of each image. So it was like 8. I don't I may be wrong, but that's what I remember. And none of them was there. And it's not just about the image. It's also about the art, the font, what type of font you have, how big the title is, the colors of the title, the placement of your name. Do you want to quote? I mean, it's there's a lot of elements that go into making a good book cover. But that old lady, I came back to her after I refused all the first batch and they sent me another batch. And I kind of went back to her. But then we made some adjustments in terms of color. And I have to look at her. I don't remember. I see it so much, I don't see it anymore. You know, she had a dangly earring. I felt like that got in the way of the title. You know, and they had, it was, and I gave her red glasses, which she didn't have before. I mean, I made modifications of her. I think, I gotta look again. I think she wears pearls. I don't know, she's supposed to wear pearls.
No, I don't see pearls.
No. All right, well, there was one thing where they didn't do. But it was, I just felt that it was an arresting look. You know, you want to know her. You want to know about her. At least I do. Although young people probably look at it and think, oh my God, who wants to read about some old lady? So I think not everybody's going to respond to it the way I did, but I think it's, I worked hard on that cover and on the title. The title is so hard. A title that really makes you curious is very hard to come by. I mean, I had titles like, there is a dinner party in the book that all the different characters converge at the end at a dinner party that the old lady who's, I don't know, everybody's important, but we'll call her the main character, that she's woken up in the morning and decided that night to have a dinner party and nobody knows why. And everybody's curious. So everybody's going to wind up at that dinner table. So there were like dinner table settings that were some of the pictures I would get, or the titles like the dining room. I mean, for some reason, the name Alpha came to me because she is Alpha. She's, you know, very much in control of her life and everybody else's. And I hope in a nice way, but people don't hate her. So she's strong, but she's also kind. But she's, so once I came up with Alf, I changed her name to Bet. She had many names during the course of writing. There's something in Word called find replace. So names can change very quickly. And sometimes when I'm writing, I start out with a name of somebody who that character reminds me of that character in real life. One time I was working on something and the main character reminded me for some reason of Debbie Reynolds. So I named her Debbie for a long time. And then when it was over, I changed the name. But something that always, you know, that helps you kind of see that character and think about that character.
And I think, I mean, I love marketing and everything. And it is, to me, it's a book that, you know, if I hadn't connected with it, that it would grab my attention. And, you know, you're thinking that the, you know, younger mightn't be, you know, interested in that. But like everybody's got somebody, whether it's the mother or the grandmother, that
oh, yeah,
there's
young people.
And they connect with it that way. Like, it's a little
reminder. Well, we're all in families. You either have the grandmother or you've got the children or whatever. Everybody's a family member. And, you know, one of the things I did when I was trying to let the publishers know what I like was that I had played around with AI. And I had gotten, it's so much fun. You know, you put in kind of a synopsis or the character description. And then I had put in different artists to see what they came up with. And the one actually that was closest to the colors in this book was Hockney. You know, I always think of, you know, with these bright, you know, primary colors, and I just feel like they're very attractive. I looked at a lot of book covers. It's fun to look at book covers that attract your attention. I mean, some of them really grab you. And then I also worked hard on a first line, although my husband thinks the first line of the book, nobody's going to want to read it because... Well, I won't tell you. You read the book, you got through the book, so it didn't stop you. Some people think it's funny, which is what I think it is. And other people have to get my sense of humor, I think.
No, I did. I loved your sense of humor. Yeah.
But, somebody asked me, how do I make it funny? Well, I don't know. I see humor in life. I see humor in things that nobody should see humor in. I mean, I don't know. I just have a weird, perverse sense of humor. So I have to tone it down a little, but anyway, it's I'm working on a second book now based on a couple some of the somebody asked me, how do you let go of those characters? And I said, I'm not. Some of them are going to live on in my next book, which I'm working on, because I like those characters and I want to know even more about them. So it's the character of the nasty neighbor. And it's going to go in all different directions, but it's only going to be told from her point of view. And that's going to be, I think that's in a way harder for me than the multiple points of view. Because you have to know what other people, you can never, if you have writing from the third person in kind of in the voice of your main character, and then another character comes in. Let's just do a, for instance, for example, I'm the main character, you and I are talking and I write, and Roy was thinking such and such. I don't know what you're thinking. So I have to somehow, it's the same way in screenwriting where you can't write interior. You can't put somebody's interior thoughts, because it has to be actionable. What you write, you have to be able to see. So I can't write about what you're thinking, right? I can guess what you're thinking. There's ways in which you can somehow get around that, but you can never write directly what somebody else is thinking who's not your main character.
And because as I was reading it, I was thinking this would make a great movie. Is it something that is possible?
Well, everybody says that to me, and I think it would have to be quite different. It's not on my horizon right now, because I just made a movie this year. And now we're in 24. In 23, we filmed a movie that had actually been almost 10 years in the making. I had read a book by a writer, Lisa O'Donnell, called Closed Doors in about 2014. And it took place in Ireland, in Scotland, in an island in Scotland. And it's a story of family trauma. And it's about there's a young kid and he's kind of, everything is his point of view. And it's done about the impact of trauma more than the trauma. Well, our movie is much more focused on the impact. We don't, the people who are, there's no court case or any of that. It's just about how it reflects, how it impacts everybody. But I was very taken by it and I optioned it. And initially Lisa had done a couple of screenplays and she's a wonderful writer, but it was very much in her voice, the kind of her point of view of, it's the Scottish point of view. And I was advised that it's far easier commercially to get a film made in the United States. And so I sort of took over the writing of it. And I spent a long time writing this and getting it to the point I wanted to. And along the route, without going into detail, I got somebody, a woman, Erin Miller, who was also interested in it, and she helped me with numerous, I mean, God knows how many drafts. and finally, we felt it was ready to find a director. And that takes, finding the right director for your film is a long process. And so finally, we got a director and COVID rolled around. So it's been a long process, but we filmed it in Minnesota, which is a state. We arrived, I don't know what it's like in Poland, but we arrived in May and it was snowing. So it's supposed to take, a lot of it takes place in summer. I mean, there are some scenes where they had to paint the leaves green or put leaves on trees. It's funny, after we filmed it. But I went through the process last year of both finishing this book, getting it out, marketing this book, filming a movie, and going into post-production, which was, you know, there's just so much, and I was a producer on it too. So at this moment, and we're on the fest, entered in a couple of festivals, and we'll continue to do the festival route, because I think it's a good movie. I think it's a very good movie, and it's we'll see what happens. But having just gone through that process, I know how long it takes. I am not young. You said how old I was. How much time do I have?
Yeah, but you're 21. You have a 21-year-old heart. That's the most important thing.
Well, I hope my body, I actually had a checkup yesterday. I'm very, very blessed with good health and good genes, because my mother had this energy, this drive and energy. One of my sisters has it. The other doesn't have it the same way. I don't know. I'm definitely driven. I'm driven to get my father's approval, which is never going to happen. When I got a master's degree, my father said, and first of all, I dropped out of college. I didn't drop out to get married, but I wound up getting married before I went back to college. And I didn't get my degree until the year I had my fifth child. And, you know, going to school and having five children and over a 14-year age range and different schools and transportation and after schools and everything else. I mean, I'm lucky I got it. And then I went and got a master's degree. And the year I got the master's, all my kids, we were all in school at the same time. It was really fun at every level. I'm doing a master's. My daughter was in college. One is in high school, you know, all down to nursery school. We hit every level. And my father said to me, listen, he's not alive. I can't be sure it's a direct quote, but I think what he said is, when are you going to get your PhD? And I thought, oh my God. He's also said to me, you can never know more than I know, which is, you know, a lot to me. I used to think I was driven kind of, and my sisters thought, I'm still think that I was driven to kind of get my father's approval. I no longer think that, because that goes back to my mother's diaries. She was always trying to achieve. She never did enough. I so identified with how she felt. Like every day she had to have so much that she achieved. And so I think that I'm also, I think at this point it has a life of its own. I'm driven because I love what I do. I'm a happy person. I love my life. I've got a big family, a lot of grandchildren. Right now I'm knitting a doll for the friend of one of my, the partner of one of my grandchildren who just started college, so she can snuggle with him at night. And, you know, things like that just give me so much pleasure. There's so many things I do in my life that just give me simple things. But I wake up in the morning waiting to go and start writing. I mean, this is so, I don't know what you asked me. I've gone on a rant.
No, that's beautiful.
You have to stop me.
No, I'm enjoying it.
Stop me. Tell me. Shut up. I've heard enough. No.
So you self-publish, I believe, yeah? Was it a hybrid publishing? Hybrid.
Well, there's different ways of self-publishing. You can, I think, and I haven't done it, so I don't know the answer, but I think you can just send your book off to Kindle or something, and they will publish it for you, and you can pay some prices to advertise and stuff, but they're not going to edit it and copy it and do all the things that mine did, and plus which they'll take anything. Whereas I reached out to a few. I made a decision when I saw what my friends, I have the people in my writing group have all been published last year. One of them's on her seventh book, I think. And so I learn a lot about the publishing business from other people, and I know one of my friends who had a book that she spent years writing, and she did get a wonderful publisher, but it took like 3 years, and they would send you ideas for the cover, and they would give you ideas for, or you would work with them on ideas of titles, but you didn't have final approval. And the, both the time frame and the type of control, I just felt like, you know, I'm too old to wait 3 years to put out a book. I just don't, I'm also too controlling. I care about the cover. I've seen covers that I don't think are, you know, attract your attention. And I just felt so strongly about these things that, and I had lunch with somebody who was telling me about a very well-known person who was also older, who could get a book, you know, a book published in, you know, just by a phone call, but had chosen not to because he didn't want to spend the time in that process. And I felt like I have a book. I've been through a copy editor already. I have it in, you know, pretty good condition. I sent it out to public hybrid publishers who, I mean, I had the, from the time from February, I signed the contract and it was out by the end of August. That's pretty fast.
Oh, that's excellent too.
And one of the reasons it was fast is that they felt that it didn't need any changes, because they also sometimes will recommend, because they only accept, the publisher I used only accepts 15% of submissions. And they have a, you know, they have a stake, you know, they have a little finger in your grosses as well. And so they want it to, they want it to sell. So they will often, they suggested a copy edit, even though I'd done that. And it's so amazing how, you know, I think it was combed through again, you'd still find mistakes, you know, just little things like, you know, a word you forget, a little word, a misspelling, you know, it's, so I did have the copy editing done. And, but I, but they felt it didn't need to have a real developmental edit done. So I had done all that ahead of time. So I felt it was, you know, it was as far as I could take it. Now, if I had gone the other route and gotten an agent, which I think I could have, but an agent may have made suggestions, so I'd have to go back to the drawing board. They may have wanted me to work with it. Then if they had found a publisher, which may have taken also another year, I don't know. They may not have found one. Then they might have suggestions. I mean, it's a long process. And I don't mean to make it sound daunting to people, but it, but it's there's so much you don't know about what's involved in actually getting a book out into the world. You look at a book and you think, oh, they sent it off and that was the end of it. And once you've got a book out there, you've got to learn a whole new occupation. You have to learn how to be a marketer. I mean, it's been a lot of it. I've had a lot of education, both in marketing a book and in producing a movie and then doing other things. It's been quite a time for me. So back to whether this book will ever be a movie. I would love to get somebody who wanted, who was interested, but then I wouldn't be happy with it. So I'll, you know, it's in the back of my mind, I'm working on my second novel, which is based on that character. And I'm fairly far along if I could find the time. Would I then want to go back and revisit it? Maybe. I might. I'd love to get like Reese's Book Club, who wanted to read it and take it and make a movie out of it, but that's not gonna, it's unlikely. So I'm just doing my own way, see what happens.
And just finally, the audio. Have you created the audio, or do you plan to have
yes,
the
I
audio?
Yes, I do have. I have an Audible book.
Okay. Did you use your own? Did you narrate it yourself?
No.
No.
No. Well, I don't know if I'm that good a reader. I don't know that I am. But there was an actress I wanted to do it, but she kept saying, oh, I'm not good at it. She would have been very good. They gave me several choices of people. And I think the narrator is good. But it's, the as I mentioned, my book is all different characters, and they all have a point of view. So you have to be a young Iranian guy, a young Croatian woman. You've got to be an old lady. You've got to be the daughter of the old lady who's got her own voice. I mean, you have to be able to distinguish the characters, and it's not that easy a job. I don't think I could have done it. The most brilliant person ever was Jim Dale, who did the Harry. I don't know if you ever heard of any of his Harry Potter. He did all the characters in the Harry Potter books, and it was incredible. And I heard that what he would do is he would record each voice of each character to make them all different, and then when he was reading a segment, he would find out who those, he would listen to who those characters were, and then he would bring them to life.
Oh,
I am not an actor.
Yeah, that's a serious talent to have, to be able to do that.
Yeah, I could have done the old lady, maybe. That's that. I don't know how I would have done the young girl, because I don't know if my voice sounds old. I don't know.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Listen, Jennifer, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. You might let
Thank
people
you.
Know where they can find you.
They can find me. I have a website, Jennifer. It's HTTPS, you know, the whole thing. Not www, but https://. JenniferMenacharian.net. Should I spell my name, or is
no?
That gonna,
I'll put it both in the
all
audio
right, and then
and
I'm,
video that they can find the links.
Right,
so.
Yeah, and on that website I have other things I do, by some of the a couple of films that I've been involved with, and just various things I've done, and so it has information about me. It has information about the book. I think there's portions of the book that somebody can read. It takes you to the websites where you can buy it. And it also has a bunch of my PR stuff. So you don't want to listen to a lot of it, because you'll just hear the same thing and be very bored. But I'm on Instagram under as well. If you click on the links at the top of the website, it'll take you to each of Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, you know, all the things you have to be on. I'm on online book sites. So any online book site, you can get both an ebook, a paperback book, or a Audible. And if anybody likes the book and wanted to set, you know, have a book club friends do it or something, you can go to a local bookstore and ask them to order it. And they can order the book and through a company called Ingram. And the thing about Ingram that's good is that they can return them if they don't sell all of them. So if local booksellers wanted to buy this book and offer it, you know, I got a good cover to look at. So give it a try. Put it out for Mother's Day.
I'll make sure I put all your the Facebook, the Instagram, all of them on the show notes for both the audio and video. And what I would say is, this is the book again, so that you know what to find it. And when you do get it, what I encourage you to do is make sure you give Jennifer a 5-star rating, because it really helps, because it puts it up the charts and it makes all the different bookstores kind of realize this is popular, and it'll share it to other people. And also, maybe perhaps if you really enjoy it, take a picture of it and share it on your Facebook and everything, because it all helps. And who knows, we might get this movie after all, because I'd love to actually watch
it. You're so nice. That was a great thing. I mean, the stars are amazing. I mean, some, you know, I don't know that I as a reader, or forget about reader, if I buy a chair, for me to give the highest rating, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but it's my middle child, the Libra in me. I will, even if I love it, I might go for a 4. And when people give me, I read a review that says, I loved it, this, that, and then they give me 4 stars. I said, what's wrong with you? Couldn't you have given me that one extra star? It makes such a difference. But, you know, it's frustrating. I mean, some of the people in Goodreads is so funny. People will write that, you know, it really interested me and so forth. And then I didn't like the ending, and they'll give me like 1 star. And I mean, I don't know. It's frustrating. So I try not to read them very much.
I have similar on the podcast. I had for years 5-star for everything. And then I got a few bad ones. And I was like, they really went out of their way to give me. And it was a 3-star. And I was like, they really went out of their way. And what somebody said, it actually helps you with the algorithms when you've got a mix of it. So
it does? How does it help you? How?
Because it's showing there's a mix of it. You know, because some people, yeah.
I would think it'd be better if they were all perfect.
Yeah, no. So, well, that's what they're saying. That might like podcast.
But the funny thing is, somebody who doesn't like it, why do they read it to the end?
I think there's just people, come on, you know, haters will always hate, you know, so.
Well, anyway, the whole thing's been an interesting ride. And I'm hoping to stay on the train.
Oh, and I look forward to it next.
It's going to be a plane, because if I'm going to get to that, it's going to be a comfort. If I'm going to get to that movie someday.
Oh, excellent. Listen, Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you, Roy.
So that's all for the Speaking Podcast. You'll find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. Until next week, take care. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Be sure to give us a thumbs up, 5-star rating, and share with your friends. And you'll find all my shows with the QR code, or bio.link/podcaster, as well as my podcast coaching. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, danielpacker.com, helping people with anxiety, stress, and addictions. He's got a 90% success rate, and you only pay if you're successful. Also, if you'd like to go on a podcasting tour, I can help you do that. And if you're interested in sponsorship, you can contact me on my bio.link/podcaster. Until next week, take care.